Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, professor of religious studies at Hendricks College and theologian in residence of Canvas Community in Little Rock, Arkansas.
And I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning and Music at Congregation Or Chadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish, one Christian.
This week, we're reading Paul's famous discussion of love as given in 1 Corinthians 13, 1-13. It's not every day that Amy and I talk about Paul's letters and find ourselves in full agreement that Paul is in fact right. But both our Jewish and Christian traditions can fully affirm what Paul says here, that love is the one undeconstructible reality, the most fundamental principle of the cosmos, and one might say, the very essence of God. The sort of love Paul calls us to in this passage is anti-imperial, the sort of soft love that seems foolish to those who live in a world where domination, control, and pride are the logic of the day. By contrast, Paul calls us to a softer way of inhabiting the world, characterized by patience, kindness, and yielding to others, trusting and hoping in the power of love toward which the world is ultimately moving. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, it's Bible Worm time.
That it is. It is Bible Worm time. And tomorrow's your birthday.
It is my birthday.
I feel very happy to be able to record a podcast the day before your birthday.
Yeah, I feel like we recorded a podcast maybe on your birthday this year
or
something
like
that.
Yeah.
Seems like this happens like twice a year.
You have any wisdom to lay down on us, Bobby?
Getting old is rough.
Yeah.
I think that's my
Keeps
wisdom.
The alternative. Yeah.
Birthdays are great.
What kind of cake do you like?
You know, yeah. My mom always made a German chocolate cake, and I don't quite know how we got started with that. Like, it sort of seems a little bit random for my Scots-Irish family, but there we are. German chocolate. It's a good one. My wife and I, as you might well remember, although I doubt it, had a carrot cake as our wedding cake. That has been a family favorite.
I do vaguely remember that. Yeah.
People thought we were taking a little bit of a bold choice there, but I was like, if you can't choose carrot cake on your wedding day, like,
what are we
when
even
can
doing?
You choose it? Yeah.
Well, I will tell you and our listeners, I sent you something very strange.
You did?
Yes. So it will arrive sometime in the next few days.
I'm so excited.
And it's strange. Enjoy.
I can imagine so many ways that could go coming from you. And so I'm so eager to know. I can't even wait now. But wait we must.
Indeed, indeed.
So let us wait in 1 Corinthians 13, 1-13.
It's a good place to wait.
Yeah, I just came up with that off the top of my head.
It's a nice chapter, though. I tried sort of somewhat quickly reading through the intermediary chapters because we were just in chapter one.
Yeah, we've moved a long way, haven't we? Yes.
And I was like, what does happen in between? And it's a little complicated.
It's very complicated.
Things happen. So I was glad to get back to 13 and be like, okay, let's talk about love.
Yes, let's do talk about that. Yeah, 1 Corinthians, there's lots of problems in that community, which is actually relevant to what we're talking about today. But there's lots of things that are divisive, and it ranges from like lawsuits to like who's sleeping with whose mother.
Yeah.
And so to come back to love. Mm-hmm. That's a good principle.
I was working with a bat mitzvah student yesterday, and her Torah reading luckily has many, many options of what she can write her talk about, but it does have two verses that relate somehow to sex. And she was like, what's harlotry? And I was like, well, you know, and so I explained it to her and she was like, nope, let's skip to the next law. Like,
yep.
I do not want to talk about harlotry. And I was like, that's probably a good call.
That seems fair.
You don't need to talk about that.
Was there anything in your reading of, your skimming of, your perusing of chapters 2 through 12 that you did want to draw our attention to?
I mean, I think, you know, when in the first parts of it, I really felt this emphasis that we saw even in chapter 1, that there was a real sense of sort of humility and not trying to put a lot of words and details around the reality of the cross and the significance of the cross, because, you know, the significance is bigger than anything we're going to be able to figure out. And this sense that we shouldn't lean into divisions between us. But then there was real tension in like, but then when you see people doing whatever sexual thing you think they ought not be doing, you know, Paul did want people to respond to that and not just say like, oh, well, it's, who knows? It's all about love. You know, like it's complicated. Like these ideals, I read something today in preparation for this conversation that, do you remember what an asymptote is from math?
I feel like it's something approaching.
It's like
axis, but never actually getting there, or something like
that. Yes, it's some kind of calculation where the like line on the graph gets closer and closer and closer to a certain, you know, axis or line, but it's never quite going to touch it.
Right.
It was describing love in particular, the ideal of love, but I think you could put it on almost any ideal. Like we just can't quite get all the way.
Yes.
There, we're just trying to get as close to it as we can.
Oh, I love that image.
Yeah.
That's a really great way of reading this text, actually, I think.
Yeah, it was helpful to me. And it was both confusing and then also really sort of humanizing to see like, oh, Paul is kind of struggling with this too.
Yes.
Like it's not actually clear how this plays out in the ugly details of our daily lives.
Yes, yes.
That's probably not a very useful grounding, but that's the grounding I took from
it. No, I think that's really lovely. And we're going to have to deal with that issue of like, what does it mean to endure all things? And does that mean putting up with whatever? Like there's some things there we'll have to talk about. There's a passage right before this one, which we're actually going to read in 2 weeks, which is 1 Corinthians 12, which talks about the gifts of the Spirit, which Paul is going to talk about a little bit here as well. Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, Paul's idea is that God gifts different people in different ways. And the Corinthians have been elevating some of those gifts above other ones and sort of saying, I'm better than you because I can prophesy, or because I have a worm-themed Bible podcast, or whatever it might be. And so this is part of the background of 1 Corinthians 13, is even the gifts that you get from God, you're using to create divisions among yourselves. Mm. Like, what are you even doing here? So we'll come back to that text in a couple of weeks, but I do think that's partly what Paul is working out here. Mm-hmm. This passage that we're reading in 1 Corinthians 13 is quite a famous passage, and it often has been read in wedding ceremonies. Like, it's probably one of the more often used texts in Christian weddings. It is a really lovely discussion of what love looks like, but it's not really talking in the first instance about marriage or even about love between individuals. It's really talking about community and love as a broad concept. So anyway, just to say, lovely reading, and I want to value that. And also, I think there is more that this text is after.
Yeah.
So I'll start out reading 13:1-3, and I am in the Common English Bible. If I speak in tongues of human beings and of angels, but I don't have love, I'm a clanging gong or a clashing cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and I know all the mysteries and everything else, and if I have such complete faith that I can move mountains, but I don't have love, I'm nothing. If I give away everything that I have and hand over my body to feel good about what I've done, but I don't have love, I receive no benefit whatsoever.
I totally see how that's pulling on this, the idea of the gifts of the Spirit now. I hadn't quite put that together before you'd held that up for us.
I'm curious what you thought before I had sort of given that framework. I'm curious where your head was otherwise.
Maybe this is kind of a strange place, but I was thinking of some passages in the prophets that I have been studying recently. And there's this passage in particular in Hosea where there's a sense that, you know, people have gone astray, and the way that they have gone astray is such that they can do things in the world in a way that they would look the same from the outside as they would if they were grounded in a relationship with God, but the things are no longer satisfying because they're not grounded there.
Yes.
So like Hosea 4 imagines this situation like this, where it says, and you'll eat and not be sated, and you'll drink and not be satisfied. And then goes on to this pervasive metaphor of harlotry, which is has all kinds of problems in it. I do not like that metaphor. But it's another example of a sort of normal, godly human drive or appetite that now seems impossible to satisfy because you're doing the thing, but it's not working because it's this like hollow performance of something that you've drained the meaning out of.
I really
love
that.
That's where my mind went.
Yeah. But and I think that's actually going to sort of shape all the way through this passage, all the way through the whole chapter, having that idea of if you do not have the underlying thing, then the outward expressions are hollow or shallow or temporary or something, unsatisfied, unsatisfiable. I really like that connection.
Yeah.
These three verses, in a sense, they say the same thing three times, but in sort of this, like, I don't know, they feel like they're progressing or they're getting like amped up or something. So I just want to start with this first verse, which compares speaking in tongues, first of humans and then of angels, but with doing it lacking love, is like a clanging gong or a clashing cymbal. Can you talk to me about how you read that image?
Well, the first thing I thought of was this Yiddish phrase that my dad used to say to me sometimes, hoch mi nikta chinik, like it literally means stop banging me a teacup, which means like you're just making no, like stop, like you're bothering me about something. Okay, that's not what Paul is talking about.
It is a little bit, I think.
I mean, I think it's just sometimes we feel like we're a comp. Okay, this is really dumb, but my sister today sent me this quote that she found from some online recipe of how to make something. And it was basically like, in order to make tzatziki meatballs, first you're going to take meatballs and then we're going to put tzatziki on them. That was the first sentence of this article. And both of us were like, "What? This is what is wrong in the world. Like, just because you have put words there doesn't mean you have said anything."
Yes.
You have not said anything. So I think this is, I mean, this is obviously much deeper than that in terms of like, what is the purpose of speech? Like, what is it that we're actually trying to do? It should be communicating something real and grounded. But you can feel like you're doing something just by saying words.
Yes.
And, but you're not.
I love that. It was connecting me a little bit back to our conversation from last time in 1 Corinthians 1 about preaching that doesn't point in the right direction, but is sort of preaching for its own accord.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like this bit about speaking in tongues of human beings. Like you could be the most amazing orator who ever orated.
Yes.
And if you're not speaking out of love, then you might as well be clanging a gong or clashing a cymbal. I can tell you as a parent of young children that the clanging and clashing of things is not a pleasant experience for those who listen to it.
That is true.
And so, yes, so you think you are speaking in this beautiful, melodic, profound way, but in fact, it is just an irritating, repetitive noise.
Yeah, yeah.
The tongues of angels, how do you read that? So tongues of humans, tongues of angels. You have any thoughts about that connection?
I didn't pay a lot. Well, I guess when I first read it, I saw it just as a way to make the example bigger. Like even if you can have the voice of an angel, even if you speak in the tongues of angels. Although I will say there is also in Jewish tradition a lot of interest in trying to understand the way that angels praise God and the way that angels pray and seeing if we can imitate that in our prayer, sort of imagining that the angelic beings are the closest ones to God. And so whatever they're doing is probably what we should aspire to. So I don't know if some of that is in here also.
Yeah. No, those are, I love that, both of those connections. Because I think you can read it just as a rhetorical flourish. So, yeah. You know, you hear people say, like, she sings like an angel.
Right.
You know, I think it's could be read that kind of way, and I think it works that kind of way. There is also, among the list of spiritual gifts that Paul gives in chapter 12, in that chapter, he uses the term glossolalia, which seems to be a technical term for somebody who is actually able to speak angel. And there were manifestations of that gift in Paul's communities. In Pentecostal communities today, Pentecostal Christian communities, there are still people who express that gift, and they'll speak in a language that they themselves don't understand. They're not choosing to speak that language. It just like flows through them and they speak it. And so Paul probably is also referring to that. Mm-hmm. We find out in the next chapter in 1 Corinthians 14 that people who have that particular gift have come to think of themselves as better than people in the community who do not have that gift. Mm-hmm. And so this is one example of that we were talking about earlier, of division that's been created by the giftedness that people have. And so I think Paul has taken a jab at that. So it's both like people who speak beautifully. If you speak without love, you don't have it. But also people who have this, what is really a profound spiritual gift, but you can ruin that thing if you don't use it in love.
Yes.
He then says the same thing about prophecy and knowing all the mysteries in the CEB, all the mysteries and everything else. Even faith that you can move mountains. Like, these are big
things. These are significant things.
Yes.
Yes.
And that moving of mountains, Jesus famously in the Gospels says, if you have faith of as big as a mustard seed, you could move a mountain. So these things are good in themselves.
Yes.
If you do it without love, and in the CEB, I am nothing. Like, that, it's not just that it's, like, before it was at least the sound of a clanging cymbal. Now it is all of these amazing things are like nothing at all. Yep.
Yeah.
Thoughts about what he's saying there?
I mean, I just am, my feeling is that it's maybe the note you just added about speaking in tongues mitigates this feeling I'm having, but that it's moving closer to God in some way. I mean, to have like the true capacity to prophecy and to understand everything and have faith to move mountains. Like, these are really significant, quote unquote, like accomplishments.
Yes.
And it made me think actually of a documentary from a long time ago called Race to Nowhere, which itself makes me think of the Book of Qohelet, but which is about how our school systems are set up so that our kids are just trying to accomplish and accomplish and accomplish. And they think that it's going somewhere, like all of this matters. But in the end, there's nowhere to go. There's no end to that. There's no, it will never be satisfied and it never goes anywhere. But the idea that that can be applied to something like prophecy and faith that will move mountains, that's wild.
Yes.
Like that you can have those gifts and that it can somehow be meaningless if it's not, you know, grounded properly.
I love that way of talking about it, Amy. So it's like it's almost like you've moved up on the scale of perceived value of the thing, right? Now, so now it's not just that you speak well, but it's that you know all the mysteries of the universe and you have this profound faith. Like you have notched up in a sense from somebody who is a good speaker. And so maybe you're thinking like, okay, now here's something. And then his conclusion is, I'm nothing at all. I'm a nobody, he says. So the total negation, even though it seems like this person actually, I mean, it's a hypothetical person, but does have the gift of prophecy. They do know
it's
everything.
Not false
they can
prophecy.
Move mountains.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's a pretty shocking statement.
It really is. Yeah. I'm just trying to think, like, if we were hanging out and you were like, watch that mountain over there, Bobby. And then you like moved the mountain and then to be like, okay,
but is
like
that
to say like that's
love?
Nothing if you, I mean, but you would have grounded in the love, not in
I'm
boasting, because that's just who you are.
Yeah. It's hard to even imagine how these things would happen in a way that is not godly.
Yeah.
But maybe we, you know, I'm sure over the course of this passage, we can talk more about what we're talking about with what you mean love.
So these first two have been sort of about gifts that have been given by God. So the ability to speak and talk in glossolalia, the ability to move mountains, the ability of prophecy. The third one is a little bit of a shift. If I give away everything I have, if I hand over my body, you know, to feel good about what I've done, the CEB says, but I don't have love, I receive no benefit. Can you talk about that one?
I mean, these are the things that, to my mind, that Jesus kept asking of people in the gospel. And we kept remarking how it is just so hard. It is just, it feels almost impossible to ask a human who is enmeshed in human systems and empire to give up everything they own and make themselves completely vulnerable and be willing to endure sufferings of the body. These are huge asks. And the person's doing it. They're doing it. But, you know, so that I may boast, I mean, we talked about that a little bit, I think, in the last episode or maybe two episodes ago, that passage from Micah about the importance of doing all the good things, but also walking humbly with God, that if you're doing it for egotistical reasons, ultimately, it's you can cancel out even something as big as this.
As you were talking, I was thinking about our conversation about the rich man in Mark 10.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and here, I mean, it's exactly like that puts that whole story in such a, like, even if he had accomplished that and given everything away, if he was doing it begrudgingly or doing it to get credit for himself, then Paul would say that's of no benefit whatsoever. So it, like, that already high bar is even still higher.
Yeah, right.
I also think there might be something sort of positive here. Like the fact that there is not inherent benefit in handing over your body to the authorities or whatever, to like seeking to be crucified or seeking to be martyred. That, like, there may be a positive way of reading that. As, I mean, I don't think Paul intends this positively, but to say the goal is not to hand yourself over. The goal is to act in love.
Mm-hmm.
And there may come a time when acting in love means that you have to do something like that, but it is not a valued end in and of itself.
I really like that. I like that nuance a lot.
One of the things that struck me here is, here's a choice that anybody could in theory make. Like, I cannot choose to have the faith that moves a mountain, but I can choose, like,
that's true,
to hand over my body or to give away everything I own. Like, I could go do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there have been times in my life where I have given things away. I had a period in my life in my 20s where I would just give stuff to people, and I was very proud of myself about that. And so this is sort of a little bit, you know, like making you think about what your motivations might have been.
It's so complicated.
I gave away my stereo, and I'm still sad about that. Like, it was a good stereo.
Someone else is hopefully still enjoying it. I don't know. It's been a long time.
It's been a long time.
Hello, fellow Bible worms. My name is Amy Marie Epp. I'm a pastor at Seattle Mennonite Church in Seattle, Washington. I support Bible Worm at the early worm level, $8 a month, and I consider that professional budget dollars very well spent. What I especially love about being a patron at this level is having access to those podcast episodes a week early, since I'm often working that far ahead on sermons or on worship prep. Also, by the way, I love the sticker, which I put on my water bottle immediately. Amy and Bobby's insight and wisdom have become an invaluable resource for me. I look forward every week to hearing them chew through that biblical text together with curiosity and with humor. It feels like I'm a part of the conversation. That's why I wanted to support them in making Bible Worm possible. It still feels like a gift each week to have that Patreon episode land in my inbox. I hope all of you who are listening will also consider becoming patrons. And now, back to this week's episode.
Anything else you want to say about those three verses?
One other thing, maybe, that other people looking at you doing those things may not be able to tell what your motivation is. Like that part of it. I don't know. I don't know if Paul's imagining that people can tell, you know, whether someone is doing something out of love or not. But it's a question for me.
That is interesting. And I think it leads us into this next section of the text actually quite nicely. Because Paul is trying to describe here what love looks like, or how one knows if what you are experiencing or expressing is love. This is probably the most famous part of this passage, picking up in verse 4. Love is patient. Love is kind. It isn't jealous. It doesn't brag. It isn't arrogant. It isn't rude. It doesn't seek its own advantage. It isn't irritable. It doesn't keep a record of complaints. It isn't happy with injustice, but it is happy with the truth. Love puts up with all things, trusts in all things, hopes for all things, endures all things. So I'm going to want to come back to verse 7. So let's just put a pin in that one.
Yeah. Okay.
But in these first verses 4 through 6, are there ones of those that particularly were striking to you, stood out to you?
That's a really good question, Bobby. I think what stands out to me most would probably be love is patient. Because sometimes when I love something a lot, I feel like it has a real urgency about it.
Yes.
Like the love has an intensity about it that it does not lend itself easily to patience. Which, I don't know, like reading this section, honestly, the question I wrote down on this verse is the horrible question. Like, what do you mean, love? Like, is love a force in the world? Is love a feeling? I almost had trouble sort of plugging into what kind of entity is love.
That's so interesting, because I think where I sort of short-circuited that question in my own head, and it was because when you and I talk about love often, although we're generally talking about it from like Deuteronomy, is like, what are the actions in the world that you are doing based on, like, how are you treating people? How are you entering into community? And is that loving your neighbor, or is that loving your community? And so that's kind of where I went with it, is like, how are you entering into this space? And is it all of these things? If yes, then you are expressing love in your community. If no, then you are not. I don't know what you think about that.
I think that if I had encountered these verses without the ones that came before them, I would have been inclined to read it the same way that you're reading it. But somehow for me, verses 1 to 3 are asking me to do these particular, like, really big actions in the world. I guess I see it sort of as like somehow weaving love into it. And so that, I don't know. So it started to feel to me more like a disposition in the world, or like a posture, or a state of being, or something like that. That does certainly manifest in actions. And maybe this is a good checklist for what is your state of being, you know, as humans. Maybe it's easier to sort of go backwards and say, like, well, do your actions reflect that kind of state of being?
That's such a helpful way of talking about that, Amy. I really appreciate it. One thing that you were saying that I was making me think that you and I are actually reading verses 1 to 3 slightly differently, because what you were saying was there is an invitation or an expectation to do these big things and also to do them with love. And the way that I had been reading that was more, even if you could do these big things, but you don't have love, you might as well be doing nothing, which sort of relativized all the big things and sort of said, you need to do, like, love is the thing you need to do.
Yes.
I think that's right. Made that feel smaller to me, which is kind of interesting.
No, I mean, I think you're right. I guess I saw them more woven together in the first three verses, yeah. But I think you're right. I think it's saying like, if your end goal is to do this big thing, but it's not grounded in love, you're misguided. Like you're not actually doing anything.
I really love where you connected that. And the second thing I noticed in what you were saying before was about love as a disposition, or love as like a habitual practice or something like that. Mm-hmm. That wasn't your word, but I think there's something really important about that, that there is this way in which love is an outward expression. It is a way that you enter into community, but it is also an inner habit that you become so trained in that everything you do exudes love. Mm-hmm. And so we can then talk about it as it exudes patience, it exudes kindness, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's not simply like actions. It is the essence that you have shaped. It's that asymptote you were talking about. Like, as you do the actions, you become a more loving person. As you become a more loving person, your actions become more loving. And it's like a practice ground. It's like running the scales if you're going to play the symphony, you know?
Yeah, this might, I don't know, maybe this is too personal to say, but in my own practice of trying to be more aware of or feeling closer to what I imagine God is or God is like, which is not necessarily the kind of entity that the Bible seems to imagine. it is much more about grounding in something like this, like some kind of like force that is in the world and in the universe that is this.
Yes.
So I feel like at this moment in my life, I don't think I read it this way the last time we read it, but at this moment in my life, when I read the word love, it's like standing in for some kind of really like fundamental force that is flowing through the universe, but it can be quiet and you can ignore it, or you can not ignore it and really make that the thing that flows through you and flows out of you.
I love that, Amy. And there's a passage in 1 John, the letter, that says God is love. And so I think that is pretty close in a sense to what you're saying. And then later on in this passage, we're going to find out that love is one of the things that remains when all else has failed, which is also a way of talking about God, right?
Yes.
And so I think that what you're onto there is a nice reading of this passage. To me, this list is a nice way of thinking about like what is the characteristics of love. And it's a benchmark for me about who I am being in the world. And so sometimes I'll go back and check this list and say, in my relationships with people close to me, in my relationships with my community, am I being these things or am I being something else? And it's a nice way of me sort of measuring how I am as a loving person or somebody who inevitably falls short of being loving. It's also a way sometimes when I want to talk to somebody else about whether their community or their significant other or whomever is doing right by them, I sort of, in a Christian context anyway, point them to this list and say, like, is this how you experience your community or your partner or your, and if not, then I think, you know, maybe you need to think about that. So I just find this an interesting kind of way of imagining, here's how we should be in relationship with others.
Yeah.
Does that sound helpful to you or not helpful to you?
It does. And it's in some ways, I mean, I feel like it's in direct conflict with what I would describe as sort of ego, or like our sense of ourselves in the world. Like, how do you put your stamp on something, and how do you, you know, make a name for yourself in the world? Like all these messages that we get about what success looks like. This is it's so soft.
Yeah.
And so I feel like the question that these verses keep asking me is like, how can I soften a little more? Even a little more.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll get to verse 7 and say like, well, do we want to be like totally soft all the time?
Yeah.
But I think as a default, and it's still, it is hard, even though I believe this on some level, it is still hard for me to believe it enough to not be afraid of looking stupid or putting out something of poor quality or I don't know what. There are all these ways that the world invites us into arguments.
Yes.
And this is really saying, like, you can just be present with what is.
Yes.
And just be soft.
I love that way of talking about it, Amy. And, you know, if you are soft, the world is going to take advantage of you. Like, that would be the response to this. Yes. And this is what Paul was saying in our reading last week, that living out the gospel is foolishness to those who are living the ways of the empire, right? And so, yeah, exactly. It looks naive. It looks stupid. It looks weak. And this is the way, I think in Paul's understanding, this is what Jesus kind of looked like. Mm-hmm. And therefore, so should the community. And it is a way of kind of getting run over by the empire. Mm-hmm. And part of Paul's problem with the Corinthians is that they're not doing this. They're exactly trying to make a name for themselves, establish the hierarchy, say my gifts are better than your gifts. Or even like, I do not always need people to know that my gifts are better than theirs, but I need people to know that I have gifts. Like, mm-hmm. I need there to be something that I have that people are like, oh, wow, that's impressive, which is such an empire thing, right? Like, your value is in your createdness by God. And so you are inherently worthy of love, even if nothing. Yeah. And I struggle with that. And I think the Corinthians struggled with that. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of what Paul is after here.
But I think there really is a sense that if you really, you know, get it or really bought into the ideas that of, you know, this kingdom of God that Jesus has brought about, or the kingdom of God that the Jewish community espouses, that the outcome of that will be, it doesn't matter. All this other stuff doesn't matter. Everyone else can think you're dumb or like you have no reason to be irritable, because what a gift that you were born into a body today, even if your body feels crummy. You know, like, I don't know. Like, there's, again, I don't get there.
Yeah.
I don't know that anyone can really get there, but I understand the idea that our attention is pulled all the time by things that don't matter.
Amy, we have gestured a couple of times to this last verse. Love puts up with all things, trusts in all things, hopes for all things, endures all things. Mm-hmm. Which to me is such a beautiful, profound verse, and also a little troubling in some ways that you have gestured toward. What do you do with that verse?
So in its, I think the power of that verse for me is in its total opposition to what I feel like I am supposed to be doing. Like, it's total giving up of control. Mm-hmm. I just, all things happen. It is. Everything is. I don't know what to do about beliefs. Like, that you just, it's like this sense of you're just totally open and everything flows through you and things happen to you. Like, it's a very soft and, you know, kind of passive way of being. Which I think in the fact that it balances maybe other ideas that are out there about what a good life should be is worthwhile to sort of try to pull us in a different direction. In its format here, though, which is pretty extreme, I don't think if that is true, then I feel like love needs to be balanced with other things.
Mm.
Don't you think? I don't know. Do you think the New Testament or Paul, just say Paul, is calling us towards this life?
I mean, Amy, that is exactly what I struggle with. I'm not sure I've put it for myself quite so well, but that's what I struggle with this verse. It does seem, at least on the first reading, it seems passive in that way and giving up control. But I'm looking at this progression of, especially these last three, trusts in or has faith in all things, hopes for all things, endures all things. And that sort of progression from faith to hope to endurance, the way that I have sort of been reading that is to recognize that, like, there is one in whom one has faith, and therefore, like, so you have faith in God, and therefore you have hope, and therefore you can endure. And so it's trust in a different set of realities. So there is sort of a passivity about the way that the world, the empire, wants you to think and trust and act and be. You are a little bit like, that's not my thing. But it's not, it's because there's another thing in which you put your trust and your hope, and therefore you can endure. So when I was thinking back about, like, well, what was Jesus like in the Gospels anyway? And it, I mean, Jesus is, like, Jesus got crucified. Like, he did live out this sort of love to an extent that he was not willing to trade that in for violence or even to save himself. But Jesus, I think you would not describe as a passive person. You would describe him as a person very actively living out a whole different thing. So I think that's where I'm trying to land. I'm not 100% sure this verse actually says that exactly, but that's kind of where I'm trying to land with it, is it's, you put your trust in a different world, and therefore your hope appears groundless in the world in which we live on a daily basis.
Right. It doesn't make sense if you're only looking at the things that the daily world gives you, but it's also not random or absent.
Right.
It's other.
Right.
So when it says all things, bears all things, my translation is believes all things, which is a very hard, I don't know how to understand that.
Yes.
Your translation was better. Hopes all things, endures all things I'm fine with, and bears all things I'm fine with. It's sort of the two in the middle that are a little bit harder for me to understand. What do you think, are all things, like the things that happen to you in your life, are all things related to God or this connection to, like, grounding ourselves in love or grounding ourselves on some other plane? How do you understand that?
The way that I have been reading it, and I'm not I'm not sure this is the right way to read it, is that basically in all circumstances, one trusts, hopes, endures. And so the object of the trust, hope, and endurance is directed toward God. But the circumstances in which one does that, like, you can put up with anything if you have trust, because it will give you hope, which will give you endurance. That's how I've been getting there.
Well, then that doesn't seem strange to me at all.
Yeah. The beliefs there, that in Greek, the word is pisteo, and it's the word faith, and belief is sort of a little bit cognitive for me. I really like the CEB's trust, faith as trust. That seems right. Like, even though the world seems like, or circumstances seem like they have gone astray, yet you still trust that God is working out something. All right, Amy, we have yet still one more kind of theologically rich passage here. And so I'm going to pick up in verse 8.
Okay.
Love never fails. As for prophecies, they will be brought to an end. As for tongues, they will stop. As for knowledge, it will be brought to an end. We know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, what is partial will be brought to an end. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child, reason like a child, think like a child. But now that I have become a man, I've put an end to childish things. Now we see a reflection in a mirror. Then we will see face to face. Now I know partially, but then I will know completely in the same way that I have been completely known. Now faith, hope, and love remain, these three things, and the greatest of these is love. So this first part of this passage is getting to these there are some things that will end. Mm-hmm. And this world in which we are currently living in some way is only partial, like a mirror or like mm-hmm. a child's understanding. Mm-hmm. What do you think Paul is after there?
I mean, in some ways, I think it's a message that we've seen a number of times in the New Testament passages that we've read, that this world, this empire that is around you, even with prophecy in it, even with like these sort of acts of God, what you could call acts of God in the world, it's not the real thing. And as long as you keep orienting yourself towards it, you're confused.
Right.
And so we just have to, maybe it will help us to orient towards this other, like much softer and subtler truth, to think, to remind ourselves that that is what endures and that is what's real. And this other stuff is, you know, a bunch of funhouse mirrors all around us, but it's yeah. not real.
I really like that, Amy. I mean, it is not the fundamental reality of what is, maybe.
Yeah.
There is another yeah. reality that is deeper than this one. I really like that. And I think there is, this is an this is Paul being apocalyptic in his own way and saying there is a world in which we live and there is a deeper world that is God's world, and they are overlapping mm-hmm. such that the things we take to be fundamentally true are themselves contingent and ultimately will fade away. He is also saying things like prophecy and speaking in tongues and knowledge. These things will also fade away. And so at least a couple of those, prophecy and tongues, those are not things of empire. Those are actually That's things right. of the kingdom of heaven. Mm-hmm. And so even those things will fade away. And so he's doing, I think, what you said, and also there's something going on here about the way that I think about it. The language that gets used in my tradition a lot is the inbreaking of the kingdom of heaven. I think I've mm-hmm. talked about that on the podcast with some frequency, that there is this way that God's kingdom will be, and that it plays out in the world today, here and there, now and then, in Christian communities, mm-hmm. maybe in other places as well, where you see kind of what it's going to look like. But you see what it's going to look like in, like it's in a mirror, or mm-hmm. like you can see what an adult is going to be like partially by the what they are like as a child. Mm-hmm. You see some version of it. When God comes in God's fullness, you don't need prophecy anymore, right? Because mm-hmm. that has been mm-hmm. fulfilled. When God comes in fullness, you don't need the tongues of angels anymore, because you and God will be able to communicate with each other. And so it's anticipating that there's this future reality, I think, in which love actually is going to be realized, like the asymptote is actually going to touch mm-hmm. and be completed. But you and I can't ever make that happen. We can only ever approximate it, as you were saying before. Mm-hmm. When all of that, when God comes in fullness and all of that other stuff fades away, both the things of the empire, the things of the partial Christian community, what is left when God finally arises is these three things: faith, hope, love. And then Paul says the greatest of these is love. I mean, that's such a profound verse and like so important in my tradition. And I'm just curious what it reads like to you. I shouldn't have said it's profound and like fundamental and then asked you what you think about it.
No. Because it is. And I think that's part of what makes it hard, is that it is profound and it's everywhere.
Yes.
And so it accumulates a lot of memories of seeing it and hearing it in different places and different contexts. And so it's really difficult, even for me as someone outside the tradition, to come to it, you know, fresh.
Right, right.
But I think in the context of this conversation, what it's nudging me to, at least right now, is as much as faith and hope are important, and, you know, this is coming from a zealot, like Paul's faith is like
yeah.
hardcore, and he thinks he's right. Like
yes.
he knows stuff.
Yes.
And he is pointing to love that we have just described as this incredibly soft, open, present, like, it seems kind of porous, like just letting things move through you and not feeling like you need to grab hold of things and not feeling like you need to be the zealot who's going to force a situation to go a particular way. And that feels profound.
I love this. I don't know, for some reason the other day I was talking about, you know, Jacques Derrida and deconstruction and like everything can be sort of teased apart and its internal contradictions can be found and, mm-hmm. you know, the structures can be destabilized. And Derrida says that justice is the one undeconstructible thing. Justice is the one thing with substance.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, I think, is some version of that. Like everything's going to fall apart. And there are three things that are undeconstructible. Not justice, but faith, hope, and love. But the fact that there's three points. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, okay, there's three things that persist. And those are three really lovely things, right? There's mm-hmm. the sense of trusting in, that, you know, everything is going to be all right. God is reliable. Hoping, like, that there is some future, some goodness that is coming our way. But even if you lose those two, then it's like, but love is the one. And I really love that. Like, love is at the core of it all. Love is the one thing you can't deconstruct. I had a student in my office the other day and she was talking about some point of theology that she and her friends disagree about. And they were telling her that she's not really a Christian and that God is going to be upset with her. And she, you know, and this was the verse that I pointed to, was that love here, like faith, hope, love. Yes, those are important. And if push comes to shove, and you do not know what decision to make or what action to take or what belief to hold, the undeconstructible principle is love. Do the loving thing, and that will never lead you astray. Like, that's the one thing. And for in my own theology, like, I can't imagine God being upset with you if in good faith you did the most loving thing you could think to do. And in some sort of, you know, in God's mind or God's heart of hearts, it really wasn't the right thing. I don't think God's going to care.
Mm-hmm.
So be loving when all else fails. I don't know. I don't always love Paul, but this is one of the things that I really appreciate about Paul, is he's given me this as a principle.
I love that.
Amy, are there things about this passage as a passage that we should talk about?
I could ask a million questions about it, Bobby, but then we'd be here for a million years, so.
Yes, yes, yes.
I think for today, I'm ready to move on.
Well, I will invite you then to talk about the connections you see between this passage and our contemporary world or its value for contemporary communities. If you want to raise some of these other issues that you have been thinking about, you could, of course, do that.
So reading this passage in preparation for our conversation, Bobby, actually pressed me to start reading a book that recently came out that has been sitting among many other books I should read on my shelf by a rabbi and scholar named Shai Held, called Judaism is About Love.
Mm.
In his introduction, he lays out, I think, some really important points about ways in which people, both Jewish people and Christian people and people who are neither Jewish nor Christian, have gotten the idea that Christianity is about love and Judaism is about something else.
Mm.
Maybe justice or maybe law, or he actually has the phrase in there that's like justice or law or whatever.
That's amazing.
And his point is that through a lot of different sort of sociological things that have happened over the centuries, some of which probably was anti-Jewish and some of which was the Jewish community wanting to make sure we were not assimilating into the dominant practice of Christianity later. Of course, it's not dominant in this text that we're reading. Looked for ways to differentiate and saw how much Christianity talked about love and said, okay, we're going to have to lean into something else.
Yes.
And his point is that this is false, and that an orientation toward love or a disposition toward love is everywhere in Jewish practice and
yes.
and Jewish tradition, and that Jewish ethics ask for deeds of love that are done from love. And that it's from him that I actually got the asymptote image in my mind. And so anyway, I say all of that in part because this passage resonates so deeply for me as just a way to connect to something in the world that feels really deeply real and alive to me and is hard to connect to, but is always, always better when I can than yes. anything in the human world around me. And so every time I can come back to it and remind myself that this is actually the only thing there is, my life is better. And I love the way that Paul raises it up here. And I actually, for the most part, do not see any way in which this is different from Jewish teachings that surround me, or certainly not any different than my understandings of Judaism and my practice of Judaism. So my reflection is that I'm a big fan of this passage.
Yes. Well, that's a, I love that reflection.
And I'm happy to say that in a way that doesn't have any tension for me. Sometimes it's weird to read New Testament things and be like, uh-oh, I like that. What does that mean?
Yeah.
But in this case, I think we're actually on the same page, and this is actually a deep and complicated and simple teaching that holds strongly in both of our traditions.
I appreciate your saying that so clearly, Amy, because, you know, you and I feel like our religious faith leads us to being such similar people in the world that sometimes I forget that that's not always the way that Jews and Christians talk about, or especially Christians relate to and talk about Jews. And so I appreciate your just naming it, because to me it's so obvious. Like, the core of Judaism, love the Lord your God, love your neighbor mm-hmm. as yourself. Like mm-hmm. the word love, is, I mean, like, there it is.
It's everywhere. Right? It's everywhere, all the time.
Yeah. And so, of course, and I so often think about, and I mean, I think Paul does too, really, that the way in which he is thinking about Christians living out, and even the way that Jesus was living out his life, was about the way it's written in the Torah. And so there isn't any conflict there. And I think you're exactly right about that. But so often that has been read that way through the years. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that too, because what I was thinking is that this idea of love is as being the undeconstructible thing is such a powerful principle, but that it doesn't mean anything if it doesn't play out in the world in some sort of a way,
right?
Right? Just feeling love, like, it's important, but it's not anything really until it expresses itself in community. Mm-hmm. And I really am drawn to the way that you were talking about that as a disposition, something, an intention, something internal to yourself that can be, like, trained. I don't know if you said this, but I think this is where you're headed. Can be sort of trained and practiced and mm-hmm. honed, and the asymptotic, getting closer and closer to the ideal. And part of what Paul is saying, I think, is, look, if you are going to be a loving person in the world, you need to be a loving person in your community. Mm-hmm. And there are certain ways in which that's going to look. And so think about the way you're behaving in your community, mm-hmm. not because your community is the only thing that matters, but because your community is going to have to go out into yet even still a bigger world mm-hmm. and show people love. And so you practice it in your church, in your community, and then when you go out in the world, it just comes naturally to you. Mm. I've been reading my professor, Chuck Campbell, Charles L. Campbell is his official name. Mm-hmm. He wrote a commentary. He was my preaching professor at Columbia, and then he was at Duke for a while. Wrote a commentary on 1 Corinthians. And in that commentary, he's talking about the French resistance to the Nazis and he was referring to this community, Le Chambon, in which the Christian community sheltered the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And they became kind of famous, and people were, you know, doing documentaries and things about them. And they were like, how did you make such a bold decision? And they were just like, that's just what you do. Like, it wasn't a decision. It was just like, these are our neighbors. We were used to it. Like, they treat us well. We treat them well. Like, we love each other. And so when Hitler happened, there's nothing to think about.
Right.
Because you had trained yourself to love your neighbor. Hmm. And I think that's a way of understanding maybe what Paul is saying is, you've got to learn how to practice these things in your day to day, because sometimes something is going to come that's going to press your convictions, and you need to be loving because you have learned to be loving in your core. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that is to start doing that in small ways with the people close to you. And that trains you for the world out there.
I love that. You're building the muscle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. I also really appreciate your drawing attention to the countercultural aspect of this, like the soft way of life, and how that doesn't really work in the imperial logic, and that's mm-hmm. what this passage seems to be calling people toward. This is not something that's easy to do, or that will probably get you a lot of accolades from other kinds of places, but it is nonetheless, for Paul anyway, the thing that actually matters.
Right. It is, yes, it is the true thing.
Amy, I appreciate this conversation so much, and I love the sort of insights that you have brought from your own reading and your own tradition, your own experience into this. It is not every day that you and I read Paul together and are like, yes, we...
it is not.
We can both affirm that.
That is true. It is not every day, but we will take it when we get it.
We could take it today, yes.
Yeah. It's a birthday gift for you.
Yes. I love it. I love it. Amy, next week, when I'm a year older than I am today, we will read together 1 Corinthians 15, which is Paul kind of contemplating the resurrection, which is a whole thing. Like, well, I don't know what we'll do with that, but it's important.
It's an
important
thing. There's a whole situation, and we're going to talk about it.
We're going to do that. 1 Corinthians 15, 1 to 26 and 51 to 57.
I look forward to it. Thanks,
Me
Bobby.
Too. See you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Bible Worm. If you've enjoyed this free podcast, we hope you'll help us keep it going by joining our Patreon for as little as $4 per month. You can also sign up for other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced and edited by Bobby Williamson. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby, and our theme music is The World at Large by Dano Songs. Many thanks to all of our Patreon supporters for helping make this podcast possible.
Join us next time when we'll discuss Paul's understanding of the resurrection of the body, as told in 1 Corinthians 15, 1-26 and 51-57. Until then, keep on digging.